13 days after Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico, President Donald Trump visited the island.
Every death is a horror. But if you look at a real catastrophe like Katrina, and you look at the tremendous hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that died, and you look at what happened here with really a storm that was just totally overpowering. Nobody's ever seen anything like this. Now, what is your death count as of this moment? 17?
16, sir.
That's Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rosselló answering the president there. At the time, less than 2 weeks after the hurricane first hit, the official government death toll was 16 people.
Now, what is your death count as of this moment? 17?
16, certified.
16 people certified. 16 people versus in the thousands. You can be very proud of all of your people, all of our people working together. 16 versus literally thousands of people. You can be very proud. Everybody around this table and everybody watching can really be very proud of what's taken place in Puerto Rico.
But as President Trump applauded his administration's efforts, Puerto Ricans were experiencing a very different reality. At that point, the power grid was completely broken, communication was almost non-existent, and news reports found it was more likely that dozens of people had died from the storm or more. Fast forward to today. The official government death toll for Hurricane Maria has climbed to 64. But one estimate by Harvard researchers puts the number of people who have died from the storm at least 4,645, more than twice as many as Hurricane Katrina. And the next hurricane season is just days away. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. It's been 252 days since Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico. With the power grid destroyed and communication difficult, many relied on radio as a crucial form of communication.
My name is Carolina Rodriguez Plaza. I'm a news director and journalist, and also radio host for Con Base en Fundamento, which is translate like the basics and fundamentals at WKJB 710 AM.
Carolina reached us just before Tuesday's broadcast of Con Base y Fundamento was set to go live. It's a radio show out of San Juan devoted totally to Hurricane Maria. The show started in the days immediately following the storm.
We just took the opportunity to help people the best way we could, which was telling them what was going on around them, since most of our citizens were without any information, any kind of source, any kind of power, lack of water, lack of essential services, and we were there to help them. We are taking calls, we are trying to help people get through what it's the catastrophe of our century, of our modern history, which is Hurricane Maria. And people are still today telling us the same stories, the same things that really, really got them in the first place. And I mean, when you have a population that's still without potable water in some areas, especially the mountain region, and you have people with lack of power every day or inconsistency in that kind of service, you can imagine how they might be feeling right now, since it's 3 days until the next hurricane season.
For journalists like Carolina, the government's official death toll of 64 never rang true.
People feel insulted. People feel neglected, and people feel like they've been lying to. 64 is not the official number. I mean, that's a joke, a very, very bad joke. And when it comes to what was published by the New England Journal of Medicine, it's estimated that the total deaths are more than 4,000. Well, that's kind of very, very accurate of what we saw as a news team, as a news production team. So people are very, very mad and very angry with our local government right now. They feel very, very afraid, and they don't trust. I mean, they don't trust the government, they don't trust the emergency response agencies, and they don't even trust their neighborhoods. But on the other hand, you do have some sort of awareness. Others are like, hey, you know what? Maria really taught us something, and that something is we need to be aware that this is going to happen. Climate change is there. Things are happening everywhere in the world, so we're not going to be the exception. We're not going to be the blessed little island in the Caribbean anymore. So we do need to get prepared, and we do need to do something for ourselves.
Carolina Rodriguez Plaza there, host of Con Base y Fundamento, the radio show out of San Juan, which is all about Hurricane Maria and its aftermath. And 8 months later, she's not going anywhere as long as there's more to say.
I'm Carolina Rodriguez Plaza. I've been with you since Hurricane Maria, and I will be here no matter what. So I'll see you next time. Soy Carolina Rodriguez Plaza y he estado contigo antes, durante y después del huracán María. Hasta la próxima.
We just heard one radio host take on the mental state of the island of Puerto Rico today. And now we turn to Frances Boulon for another perspective. She's a school psychologist and adjunct professor at the University of Puerto Rico in Río Piedras. Frances, welcome to The Takeaway.
Happy to be with you and happy to know you are concerned about Puerto Rico.
I think one of the big issues here is the psychological toll that this has taken on Puerto Ricans, both on the mainland and on the island. Can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing?
Well, first of all, I experienced the fear and the amazing force of nature that I had never experienced before, although I'm one of the fortunate ones with a sturdy house that didn't go away. But after I was able to leave the neighborhood, I felt that for the first time in my life, I thought I was in a war zone. I had never experienced anything like that.
Frances, let me ask you a question. What is the psychological profile today, on average, of the Puerto Ricans that you're working with on the island? Are you seeing depression? Are you seeing suicidal tendencies? What exactly are the symptoms of sort of PTSD, if you will, after Hurricane Maria?
I think on average, many people have recovered their normal routines, but still have some lapses of PTSD, remembering the storm. Colleagues out in the field and in clinical services have observed an increase in suicidal tendencies and depression. There are still people who are having nightmares, remembering the day of the storm. They are in despair, or they are affected by all the losses they had. But then there's a number of people that have gone back to the routine and have been able to function fully or as well as they were functioning before the storm. The impact is not over, and I am observing some new concerns as the new hurricane season approaches.
And what is that looking like?
Well, people are worried that we are going to experience these scary winds and danger again. However, I do see a lot of energy channeled into being better prepared this time, doing things to be able to have private sources of energy, for instance, plan better for drinking water and having water at homes and building more resistant places to live. I think there's a lot of energy going into that also. But the ones that were fragile before the storm, they are having more trouble recovering. Even though the mental health services are currently, many are functioning, the time that they were without medications, without services, has taken a toll.
When you say fragile before the storm, do you mean mentally fragile? Like, how do you define that?
Okay, I mean people who were undergoing therapy for depression or for other serious mental health conditions suddenly found that they couldn't reach their medical professionals. They ran out of meds and couldn't take them. Many services have reopened. Some offices have been closed.
And there was a 29% increase in suicides on the island in 2017. Do you think there's a connection to the hurricane? and the after effects?
I think there is a connection. Yes, I think some people were desperate or had no hope. There was an issue that I observed in some communities was people, families that were very hurt by the fact that some loved ones had moved away. And that made the ones staying more vulnerable because aside from their current lack of basic services, they were very concerned about having children, grandchildren, other relatives going away.
Yesterday, we learned that there were more than 4,500 Puerto Ricans killed after Hurricane Maria. What impact does knowing that number have on the social and psychological psyche of Puerto Ricans on the island?
Well, this news is spreading like wildfire. Many people never believed the death statistics were as low as they seemed. They are very angry at the lack of diligence of some government agencies in solving those problems. So they are blaming the people responsible for things like electricity and communications for the accelerated death of loved ones. I think this contributes to a feeling of anger towards the official agencies that have been entrusted to care for us and don't seem to be delivering. But collectively, I am seeing a determination to do better. But yes, the feeling that something terrible happened and we must prepare to mitigate a future situation like this, I think it is present.
Frances, thank you so much. Frances Bulon is a school psychologist and adjunct professor at the University of Puerto Rico at Río Piedras. Frances, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. And keep looking at us. Don't forget us. I think we still have a way to go, but I am betting on the resilience and determination of Puerto Ricans to help us get through.
And we want to hear from you. If you have family or friends living in Puerto Rico, tell us how they're doing. We want to know how people are coping and preparing for the upcoming hurricane season. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Asian Americans are the fastest growing ethnic group in the United States, but few colleges and universities offer Asian American studies programs. Most that do are public universities on the West Coast. But there's a national movement to change that at institutions including Williams College in Massachusetts, where Tyler Tsai is a junior. He's the son of Taiwanese and Korean immigrants.
We can't really think of American history without understanding the vital contributions of Asian Americans to American history experience as a whole. And I think that having that legitimization of the Asian American experience on an institutional level is very important for guiding how we interact with each other as students, as people, on a daily basis.
Tyler is one of a growing number of students and faculty at Williams College, along with colleges and universities across the country, that's urging administrators to create Asian American studies programs. Kirk Carapeza is the managing editor of our partner WGBH's Higher Education Desk, and he's been reporting this story and speaking to Williams students. And Paul Watanabe also joined us. He's a professor of political science and director of the Institute for Asian American Studies at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. I asked Paul, why aren't there more Asian American studies programs to begin with?
Asian Americans have been in the country, but to a considerable extent, I don't think they've been perceived of the country. The effort by Asian Americans beginning in the 60s and continuing, as you've noted, to this day, to try to get the systematic study and appreciation and understanding of that experience and of that history has been an ongoing struggle. but it's a struggle that's important today when you think of Asian Americans as the fastest growing population within the United States. The largest number of immigrants to the United States are now coming from Asia, and soon this population will be the largest immigrant population of all within the United States within a few decades. This is an experience that's been often marginalized and on the periphery. Asian Americans center it in terms of the debates that are taking place within this country historically and right to the minute. You talk about globalization, you talk about immigration, you talk about race relations. Asian Americans should be a part of those conversations and be a lens on which we discuss these larger issues of the moment.
And why do you think, I mean, outside of there being few Asian American studies programs in the United States, why do we as a country have so much trouble including the stories of Asian Americans into our history, just collectively?
Well, I think part of it is the complexity within this population. If you think about it, Asian Americans are probably the most diverse population. People talk to me, they mention Asian culture, or even sometimes talk about Asian language. Well, what's Asian culture and Asian language? We think, for example, here in Massachusetts, we have nearly 20 different Asian subgroups that represent more than 1,000 people within the Commonwealth of Massachusetts alone, with diverse histories, diverse languages, diverse circumstances. We've often been pictured as though we were racialized as sort of in the extremes, either as perpetual foreigners, never really a part of the American experience, or as model minorities, therefore not deserving of attention or not faced with problems. Both of those characterizations make it difficult for people to grasp the reality of Asian Americans, the complexity, and even the longevity of it. While the population has grown, as I pointed out, steadily, particularly since the 1960s, the fact is Asian Americans have been on our shores for nearly 200 years.
Kirk, I'm curious about whether or how Asian and Asian American students feel about what's happening on the Williams campus and whether the administration has been responsive to their demands.
The students I spoke with feel like they've been ignored for too long. Some students pointed to documentation that shows they've been demanding this for nearly 30 years, and the administrators just kind of wait them out until they graduate. But they're taking a different approach. They're pointing out that Asians and Asian Americans now make up about 17% of the student population, but Williams faculty is only 10% Asian or Asian American. And some Asian American students told me that they often feel socially and academically marginalized on campus. So that's why they're pushing the college to hire more social scientists who specialize in Asian American studies, people like Paul Watanabe.
And Kirk, you also spoke to the dean of faculty, right?
Yes. So far, the dean has met with students, and she says that they hear their concerns, but won't commit to creating an Asian American studies program at this point. Dean of faculty Lee Park, who is Korean American, told me that creating one of these programs is really complicated.
We're a small institution, and so we have to weigh different kinds of considerations when we think about starting up a new program. There are lots of different curricular areas that we don't currently offer at Williams that might be interesting to students. So Asian American Studies isn't the only curricular area that there might be interest from students or from faculty in developing.
And Tanzina, we should point out that Williams does offer Black and Latino studies programs. And while students want the college to diversify its faculty by hiring more Asian American specialists, administrators say the college can't do that because that would be carrying out race-based hiring for a certain group.
Paul, your thoughts on that?
Well, to me, it's the current struggles are representative of the consistent struggles there's been to create Asian American studies and other ethnic and racial studies programs beginning in the 1960s with civil rights struggles. It's a continuing battle to establish these programs in the beginning. It's a continuing battle today to establish them as well. But for me, the critical point is that these programs are going to face resistance from administrations, from those who argue that it's not a identifiable discipline. This is the constant thing that you hear. But to me, the expansion of these programs speaks to what the student said at the very beginning. You're talking about an experience that is central not only to these Asian Americans, not only to a growing portion of the population, which numbers about 20 million now within the United States and is growing fast, but it speaks to the experience of the Americans as a whole. The fact is that you can't talk about immigration with talking about the Chinese Exclusion Acts of 1882. How do we talk about World War II without talking about what's going on the domestic side with people like my parents who are placed in concentration camps for being Japanese Americans during World War II? And how do we talk about the so-called War on Terror and the aftermath of 9/11 without talking about the impact that it has on South Asians and others and the violence that's been visited upon them? These are central debates to Asian Americans, but they're central debates to Americans as a whole as well. And it seems to me that that becomes the basis upon which you argue whether something is critical. But as the Asian American population spreads, as it's starting to outside of the West Coast base, where most of the programs were developed, we're seeing them in the South now, we're seeing them in the Northeast, we're seeing them in the Midwest. And as they grow, particularly at public institutions, they're the ones that are more responsive to the needs of the particular, not only the students that they bring in, but the populations from which they come from. And I think those pressures and those institutions will lead to, as it has, to a spread, a gradual, slow, but steady expansion of Asian American studies programs in this country. And I hope it's a pressure, it's a movement, it's an effort that can prove irresistible and wise for people to follow.
Paul Watanabe is a professor of political science and director of the Institute for Asian American Studies at UMass Boston. And Kirk Carapeza is managing editor of the Higher Education Desk for our partner, WGBH. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Serena Williams returned to the courts on Tuesday with an early win in the French Open. You heard the match point there, courtesy of RolandGarros.com. It was her first Grand Slam match since taking time off for the birth of her daughter last September, and she made her return wearing a sleek black bodysuit and sparking a flurry of online comments.
All the moms out there that had a tough pregnancy and had to come back and try to be fierce, so in the middle of, you know, everything. So it's, that's what this represents, and it's exciting. And, you know, I think the cat suit is, you can't beat a cat suit, right?
Serena speaking to the Tennis Channel there, and Williams has been vocal about her difficult pregnancy. She underwent an emergency C-section and was bedridden for 6 weeks after giving birth to her daughter. And despite holding 23 major singles titles, going on maternity leave means that Serena Williams entered the French Open unseated. Her comeback has put a spotlight on the Women's Tennis Association policy on maternity leave and rankings, and if it should be changed. Amira Rose Davis is co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast, and she's also an assistant professor of history at Penn State. Hey, Amira.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Good.
So tell me about this rule, I guess, and how is it that Serena, one of the best tennis players ever, ends up unseated?
Yeah, so essentially, there's a very kind of vague policy in place for the WTA regarding maternity leave. To date, essentially what it is it gives a protected status so that players returning from maternity leave, similar to players returning from injury, can have what they call a protected rank. They can enter tournaments. They can enter. They're protected for 8 different events over the course of a year. However, it does not have a provision for seeding, which means somebody like Serena Williams, who left, stepped away from tennis when she got pregnant. She left as the world's number one, came back, and we saw her, for instance, a few months ago at the Miami Open, was ranked 491. And so it's, the conversation is really happening around what to do about seeding, what to do about ranks for tournaments.
Now, the basis of this is what? That an injury is similar to, are they sort of keeping injury and pregnancy and childbirth in the same sphere, if you will, and assuming that people are just not strong enough to come back, and therefore the seeding is what it is?
Right. Well, essentially, the basis was that this wasn't an issue for many years that they had to consider. It was relatively rare for players to have kids in the prime of their career. But now players are starting families or thinking about starting families. They're playing into a later age. And so this concern is being spotlighted not by just by Serena Williams, but other great players like Victoria Azarenka. And so essentially, it was just the modification of an injury policy. It wasn't considered what what do we do with maternity leave wasn't certainly the question. It was like, okay, how can we treat an absence from the sport? And so now, because of the spotlight and because of this conversation, what the WTA Players Council, for instance, wants to do is say, how about we sit down and have an actual conversation about what a robust maternity leave policy would be and how it's different than coming back from, say, a knee injury. And I think one of the things where you've seen this change already is like the schedule of return, because sometimes returning from injury has a certain timetable, but pregnancy and childbirth and then the after effects of that don't necessarily map on to a neatly defined schedule. So schedule of return, rankings, these are the things that will come up in conversation based on indications from the Players Council over the next year.
Amira, there have been other players, Victoria Azarenka and Kim Clijsters, who have come back to the game after having a baby. Have they also had to deal with this? Have they been public about their concerns about this?
Yes, and Azarenka has been particularly public about this as well. She also sits on the Players' Council. And in these issues with them as well, there's a situation where after birth, Azarenka was able to return, but then had to deal with a long custody battle. And so they have been public. And now there is some players who say, okay, we don't need to think about rankings. Like, it takes the rank spot away from another person who's worked equally as hard. But I think there's generally a movement and a push to say, hey, we need to at least go back to the drawing board with this. And so Azarenka, I think, has been right there with Serena leading the charge. And I think it's also really important to remember that it's shining a light on this issue, but this is a policy that would be in the benefit of most women on the WTA. And Azarenka has been particularly vocal about saying, this is not just about me or Serena as superstars, but this is about the fact that current policy actually dissuades people from wanting to start families. It actually dissuades women from being able to think about starting a family.
Why or is what that, to do though? Can you give us a sense for why that is? Is it because they get seated at the very bottom, at the back of the line?
Yeah, precisely, because it's almost seen as a penalty. So if you are to have a baby, you know that you're going to come back and have to work from the bottom. Getting a lower seed means you're picking draws in the tournaments in which you're going to be facing top-ranked players much sooner. We saw this with Serena at 491 playing Naomi Osaka, or meeting Venus at Indian Wells in the third round, which is like one of their earliest meetings. And so it's the idea that the way it's currently set up is actually penalizing women who have children.
Now, what about other women's sports outside of tennis? Are there similar conversations happening?
Yeah, so one of the things in tennis that makes it particularly hard versus, say, soccer, we've seen soccer moms on the U.S. Women's soccer team, Sid LaRue, Amy Rodriguez, for instance, is that the WTA considers women's tennis players independent contractors. So one of the advantages that, say, soccer or basketball have is that the players are unionized and can collectively try to bargain and push for these large-scale maternity policies. And with tennis, we're seeing that the kind of labor issue of being seen as independent contractors is one of the things that has stunted the development of a robust policy in this respect.
Amira Rose Davis is an assistant professor of history at Penn State and the co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast and a good friend of The Takeaway. Amira, thanks for breaking this down for us.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. How long is your longest relationship? The members of the Philadelphia rock band Dr. Dog have been in a relationship for 20 years, of recording and playing together, that is. Now they're marking the occasion with the release of a new album, Critical Equation. Songwriters Toby Lehman and Scott McMicken are feeling good about the big 2-0.
It's a point of pride for me, for sure.
Yeah, and a point of challenge. You know, it's kind of counterintuitive to think that something you've been doing for 20 years would be humbling or mystifying or confusing or any of those things, but it is.
But their longevity hasn't made them complacent.
I hate this word. I wish there was a better word than underdog, but like feeling like you need to reprove yourself at every single step of the way, even though it's like, oh yeah, it's thousands of people that came specifically to see you. I don't know if that's a Philly thing or the fact that for so long we opened for bands or just did festivals, and it just felt like this thing where it's just like at every step we have to prove our merit or prove our worth or prove that we're legit.
Dr. Dog stopped by to talk about getting out of a rut, the emotional work of band life, and the pressure that comes from the audience. Plus, they played their new song, Buzzing in the Light, in our studios.
I'm not alone in the mystery. I'm not alone in the mystery. I'm not alone. Feel at home in the mystery, yeah.
It's not a particularly deep song or, you know, steep with metaphor. Just feeling good about the situation and just being able to enjoy it. Contentedness. Stasis. It's such a positive way to be. Not an easy way to be. It's not easy to get there all the time, but if you can actually get there, it's just good to appreciate it when you can.
Seems to me I'm watching someone else's dream. Buzzing in the light. I'm buzzing in the light.
For so long, we've been able to do whatever we want. You know, we've never had a single or anything like that. We've always just sort of grown incrementally for 20 years. It's just been this slow, like at a grade of like 3-degree angle, just like cruising along. So there's never been any pressure from anybody to like make us do anything. So we've always been in control. So that means that we have to create the pressure to change and to grow and stuff.
Never.
These aspects of the way you think about the process and things that you take for granted are pretty irrelevant and are pretty self-imposed. There's a lot more to be gained by constantly searching for other ways of thinking about things other than your natural instincts. So I find that all to be pretty challenging in the best way. Yeah, there's a billion ways we've settled into doing things, and those are exactly the things we need to tackle and try to get around. And some of that stuff's purely creative and aesthetic, like, yeah, you know, we don't do disco beats, or, you know, there's certain effects we won't touch. But a lot of it is more like psychological and has a lot more to do with our relationships together and sort of the roles you tend to fall into in the collaborative process.
I think that's always been a strong part of our band, is just the openness for people to talk about the problems and issues. Or if you don't do that, it's just going to feel horrible. You're just going to, everything's going to suffer. And it stinks to do, and it stinks to hear when you're on the other end of it. It's horrible. If you want to be a part of something and make it better, that comes with it. You know, it's like you can't just pretend like everything's fine.
In a collaborative situation, if you don't feel comfortable as yourself and feel trusting of those around you, then the work suffers. So in order to make that better, we had to kind of dig in on one another in a few kind of salty, bittersweet sort of ways. But that's been definitely a big part of the focus in this band at this point in time, is trying to rewrite the script on whatever it is that's gotten us this far.
I can't understand the city, and I don't understand true love. And I've been under false impressions of even where I thought I was.
Creative process is a search unto itself, but then to explore in a more productive and deeper way ultimately applies itself to the songwriting process itself. And so for me, what that amounted to, which was certainly relevant to the batch of tunes that I brought to the table for this album, was scrutinizing myself less and writing faster and allowing myself to do things that maybe for a long time I thought were a joke or a novelty or out of my wheelhouse.
Coming out.
I think that's sort of always been part of our music, even when we were kids, like the precarious nature of everything. You're able to actually see, okay, this isn't just happening to me. Like, this is why it's happening. I know why it's happening because of X, Y, Z. This isn't just being thrust on me out of nowhere. You know, as you get older, you start to see that, and you start to see how your decisions and your choices actually do have an impact on you, for, you know, the further you go.
My father believed in the power and glory, and my mother believed in him. And I believe that the sun's gonna rise, no matter the shape I'm in.
Our audiences have always been awesome, you know? Like, energetic, emotive, and like singing with us, you know? And there's never really been that much of a question of like how our fans feel about our music, generally speaking, you know? All I understand about playing music, even after having played it for so long, is that the main thing that's going on up there is this sense of pressure and your ability to navigate that, either successfully or unsuccessfully, every single night. And sometimes on an unsuccessful night, you're thinking on behalf of the entire audience and you're judging yourself. And, you know, you're eating yourself alive up there. Or maybe if it's a better night, you're just feeling the broad sense of this positive energy coming back at you and everything's kind of moving smoothly, you know? I've never been able to grasp and use to my benefit this basic fact that these people are here because they're already on some level sold on what it is you do and are there to support it and are there to experience this thing that's already been a part of their life in this live and visceral kind of way, you know? And for some reason, it's taken a really long time to realize what a benefit that is.
It's a critical equation. It's the mother of the moon. And they're calling for a mixture. A little doom and gloom.
Toby Lehman and Scott McMicken of Philadelphia rock band Dr. Dog. Dr. Dog's new album, Critical Equation, is out now, and they'll be touring the U.S. this summer. Thanks so much for talking with me today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
It's a sensitive subject.